So as to the matter at hand, we are honored this weekend to have John Teacher Master Gwagu with us and a number of his students from Tallahassee Chan Center. Yesterday we had a really wonderful retreat, full-day retreat. Some of you were at, many of you probably who were at live or probably at home recovering with their bodies. It was a full day of meditation.
Wasn't that bad, was it?
Yeah. Well, you're asking the wrong group. You're the ones that are at home. Probably resting today. So, you know, Zen is a living tradition. And even though, you know, there's a lot of things we could read about Zen, the main thing is the practice of Zen. So Zen is a living transmission, and it really manifests in the living reality of those who practice it, and especially our, you know, the teachers. So Gwagu is an heir to this Chan tradition. Many of you know about Zen, but Zen is simply the Japanese way of pronouncing the character that in Chinese is Chan. And of course, Zen Chan began in China, was that where the actual transmission came from India with Bodhidharma. And it was really within the Chinese Chan tradition that it really flowered and developed. And then centuries later was transmitted to Korea and Japan and also to Vietnam. So many people may not know that Thich Nhat Hanh, he practices, it's called Thiền, is in the Zen tradition of Vietnam. And in his lineage, he is the 42nd generation from Lin Chi, great master in China. So we are all in the same world. So Gwagu is manifesting as he is today. And he manifests not only as a Chan teacher with his own Chan center and many responsibility within his Dharma Drum lineage, both nationally and internationally, but he also has what's called the full catastrophe of daily life. He's got a full-time job as an associate professor at Florida State. He's married, he has children, one of which is a teenager. As well as there are probably many other things that he has to deal with in life. So today is really my opportunity to kind of talk with him, share with him, and give us a sense of how, you know, we see the flowering of individuals in the present moment, but we also rarely see the causes and conditions that have produced them. So he said, I can ask him anything, which is only fair. Since he grilled me when I was up at his center a year ago. So you were born in Taiwan. You want to just say in a few words just a little bit about the kind of family you grew up in?
1968. Born in Taiwan, Taipei, northern part. And born to a Buddhist family. And since I was young, my early memories were actually running around in the monastery. My mother was a student of Master Guangqing, who was...
Just hold on a second. Can everybody hear him? We had a little trouble. Could you, yeah, so maybe keep it closer.
Okay.
And... No, don't do that.
This thing keeps on kind of falling.
You can do this too to kind of.
Born into a Buddhist family, my mother was a student of this ascetic monk. He practiced extreme asceticism. And not so much a Chan in terms of the Chan lineage master, but a meditation master. During the communist takeover, he escaped in 1949, but prior to that, he meditated in caves, tigers, wild beasts, subduing them. Mm-hmm. And used to. And this guy is really something very rare, Jim, mm-hmm. in modern time. He used to enter into meditative trance, not oblivion, utter clarity in meditative trance in which his metabolism completely slows down for a month at a time. Not eating, not defecating. We're talking about serious meditation mm-hmm. and not hibernation. And through that samadhi, mm-hmm. he developed healing powers mm-hmm. and clairvoyance. Widely known in Taiwan, everyone respected him. He escaped and he, you know, built a hut. And a small community developed around him. And the road to it was so treacherous because it wasn't a paved road. The funnest part for me to go there was the way there. If there was a rainstorm that had happened, our car would backslide around the edge of the cliff. Sometime we'll have to, my father or something, we're gonna get stuck. There's no road there. There's kind of a road there, you know, for cars, but very difficult to go there. I think he wanted it that way. And he was the first one who taught me meditation when I was 4. And I used to just love hanging out with him. Mm-hmm. And running around the monastery. And very good memories, you know. So that left a good impression. It's like when we were talking yesterday, your daughter, mm-hmm. you know, having a very good memory, childhood, mm-hmm. growing up in the Thich Nhat Hanh mm-hmm. community. That's so important. And that will manifest. For me, it manifested, you know, we migrated to the United States when I was 10 and met my root teacher, Master Shen Yan.
So do you want to maybe say something about, yeah, can maybe, Brian, you're a kind of an expert. Where's Brian?
We're tuning in.
We'll just get it to hold.
Yeah, I'm going to put it here. I think I was trying to put this in the back.
Yeah.
I'm going to leave it in the front so we can lower it a little bit. Yeah.
So your family emigrated to?
Just my mom.
Just your mom came.
And my brother came and myself, the three of us.
And what was like, I mean, just personally, what was that like going from one culture to another at 10 years old?
Traumatic. You know, we're upper middle class. And my father couldn't come. He was a very high official. He was in charge of psychological warfare against the communist Chinese mm-hmm. in Taiwan, you know, radio programs and stuff. So my father knew too much. Mm-hmm. So he was restricted from traveling. Mm-hmm. And then their relationship grew apart, you know, divorced and so on. And not knowing English, bullied. The only Chinese family, all white neighborhood. Mm. Everyone thought I was Bruce Lee's descendant. And my mom being a tiger mom, says to me, devastating, says to me, if you don't win fights, don't come home. Because I was bullied outside the school premise. Mm-hmm. My mom went to the principal, the fire station, you know, you can't really, it's not on school property, mm-hmm. they can't do anything. So they would just surround me. I can't go outside the circle. Serious. Back then, it was upper middle class, so no one had knives or anything. Just everyone thinks they're Muhammad Ali or some kind of wrestler. Mm-hmm. So I had to learn how to fight the wrestlers, how to fight the boxers. Yeah. And I was marginalized, of course. Mm-hmm. Got into the another type of shaved head tradition. Mm-hmm. You know, skinheads.
You?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. So you're saying that there was a lot of anger at this point?
Yeah, I should be taking the class.
Well, you're invited to participate online. It's not a class, it's just a sharing. So I mean, is that how it manifested for you? Yeah. I mean, you're talking about coming to a new culture, you don't speak the language, mm-hmm. people are marginalizing you physically.
It's not simple as anger.
Yeah, how did he deal with that?
There was a lot going on. There's a lot going on. I mean, granted, I was a dork. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe there's still pump some part of dorkness inside me as well. I mean,
that's not like your Buddha nature, is it? Essential dorkness.
The Buddha nature manifests in dorkness. You know, so. Just circumstances, you know. Aloneness, so much anger. I just dealt with it. Aloneness, marginalized. Mm-hmm. And my tribe that I found was all the other marginalized mm-hmm. people. The heavy metalists, the punk rockers. And I got involved with straight edge hardcore. Mm-hmm. Those of you who don't know, straight edge, no drugs, no alcohol, militant, thrash, hardcore music, you know?
And you're how old at this point? You're...
Well, I came when I was 10, met my teacher. And, you know, I continued to go to him, meditate.
So you had met Sheng Yan, so your mother kind of connected with him when she came here.
Yeah.
Sheng Yan is his master.
Master Sheng Yan.
Who both is quite well known in Taiwan, but also had a presence in America, New York.
And so he saw me through different phases, even mm-hmm. though he was my anchor. Mm-hmm. You know, I was without a father, mm-hmm. going through this stuff. Seed planted when I was 4, all the way to 10. And that was my refuge. Mm-hmm. And yet, you know, the condition was such that I was marginalized, so I marginalized myself. And he saw me. I mean, I remember shaving my head. He's like, oh, I like your haircut. I'm thinking I shave it for different reasons. So he kind of saw me growing up. Mm-hmm. He's always there when I needed to talk to him. So that was very important.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's why I had such a close connection with him. You know.
He never judged you for these outward changes, you accepted making, me. Lifestyle. Yeah.
He accepted me. Mm-hmm. All kinds of stages that I went through. Mm-hmm. So he was really my refuge. Mm-hmm. And you can tell, you know, when I go through my college, you know, I went to school of visual arts. Art, I did installation, and fine art painting, and then installation, sculpture. He saw me through that. integrated. By that time, I was doing retreats already, intense retreats. So I was integrating teaching of emptiness, how it manifests through the senses. Mm-hmm. You know, I started out with painting. How many of you are painters? Yeah. I started out with painting, and I felt this opposition between the painting and the viewer. You know, this perpetual. So I started to do sculpture, people can walk around it. And then I did installation, where the viewers became my art. They become part of it, that process. So he saw me through all that. Well, I did retreats. He was planning.
He was planting or planning?
Planning.
Oh, he was?
Planning.
He kind of was reeling you in
reeling,
slowly, yeah, like
reeling,
a good, good teacher, slowly.
Reeling. Give a little piece of Master Xu Yu, empty cup, translation. Retreat, let me do this, bring me back to Taiwan. I had no idea. I just thought it was a free ride to Taiwan, to the monastery, mm-hmm. while I was still in school. For me to meet everyone, all the monastics, I was the youngest. I had no idea. Thinking back, I'm like, it's introducing me to this, to others, getting ready to have this youngster.
So by then you had left this.
Oh yeah.
Hardcore, whatever, yeah, that, yeah. And now you're in college and sort of connected with him.
Yeah. Well, I was connected throughout.
Right.
I left the hardcore scene 89. We had a couple of records that came out. You got a record? we got a couple of records. But I left 89, mm-hmm. you know, and then started to do retreats. Mm-hmm. 88. And started doing retreats, 89, I left, and you know, I was in college.
So what's, if I would say, so on the inside, what's going on with you? So you're in this, you know, you, right? You,
yeah.
you come to America, you're marginalized, you don't speak the language, not very, a lot of traumatic experiences, you find your tribe, mm-hmm. you kind of, you know, find a, you know, an identity that you can feel comfortable with, mm-hmm. but then you move on from that. Now you're kind of reconnecting in a more serious way now,
yeah.
with the Dharma. So can you remember
yeah.
what it was like to be in your 20s and how that shift inside
yeah.
felt like?
Yeah.
Because it's not a normal shift for most 20-year-olds.
Well, I'm an extreme kind of guy.
Uh-huh.
I go from one end to another. It was kind of like that, you know. If I had continued in the hardcore scene, I probably wouldn't live past 20. Hmm. It was in New York City, you know. You know, the New York hardcore folks. It's not like skinhead, like white supremacy, you know. They're all like Puerto Rican, you know, Spanish, Italians, you know, Chinese, you know, blacks, they're all mixed. We all kind of evolved around the Hare Krishnas. They gave us free food.
Uh-huh.
And the Hare Krishna skinheads, I mean, the Hare Krishna in New York City, they're ex-skinheads, you know? So, but then I didn't really feel right. I went back to start doing intensive retreat with my teacher. And that's when I felt that even though there was a sense of connection, community, and an element of transcendence, self-transcendence, mm-hmm. Especially in the, I don't know if you know, mosh pit. You know what that means? You know, diving off stage, you know, all that. There's a kind of transcendence that, I don't think people knew it at the time, but they were seeking for something, mm-hmm. something more. And with Straight Edge, it's not just punk talking about blah, 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 blah. We are very, we had critical thinking. We're able to see through the veil of the infrastructure of capitalism and government, and the depth with which friendship could be like human experiences. Mm-hmm. So the lyrics are different than other types of punk, you know? And so definitely there was an element of transcendence there, mm-hmm. but there was no end, you see. So they went to the Hare Krishnas. I knew an end. I knew a path. Mm-hmm. I felt that if I was to do anything for my life, that would be of any use whatsoever. I offer my life to Dharma.
So let me ask you, was this conscious, or now you look back and you see that's what was going?
Oh, it was conscious. It was conscious.
So this, from a more formal point of view, we'd say this is your, you know, the mind that seeks the way, your bodhicitta kind of waking up and beginning to really.
Oh, I don't know about that.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
But it was definitely conscious, you know, seeing my life, the trajectory, mm-hmm. and then my surroundings, and then my refuge. It was natural. Offer my life to my teacher. And he was planting seeds, laying out a path, and was right before me. Mm-hmm. You know, I could tell that he was planning, mm-hmm. because I told him on retreat, Shifu, I'm going to become a monk with you. And he's like, yes, I know. So we're going to do this, and next week I graduate, you're going to be, you already had a plan out. I was like, you know, I already been to the Sangha, and it's just kind of planting. So
this is how, so now you're whole, and you're deciding to,
so it was
to take
offering.
Monastic vows.
It was offering. Mm-hmm. Just offering my life, myself. So that dimension, everyone give rise to bodhicitta differently, mm-hmm. or monasticism, or practice differently. Mm-hmm. For me, it was offering usefulness.
But you gave yourself really, so when you want to talk about Shen Yin, I mean, it sounds like he was the one who manifested it for you and moved you and
yeah.
dedicated. Do you want to talk, share with him, you know, just who he was and what he meant to you and how mm-hmm. the magical way he manifested the Dharma in his life?
How many of you have heard or read of Master Shen Yin's work? Born 1931, entered monasticism, 13, small village, no education. But he always had an inclination to learning and education. He taught himself in the monastery. And then 1949, communism, this internal warfare, warlordship in China, because 1911, the last Chinese dynasty came to an end. So during that whole interim of 40 some years, just internal battle warship, Japanese colonialism, you know, Western imperial power cutting up China like a piece of pie. You know about that, right? Colonialism. And it's just internal, external. He was born during that time. Mm-hmm. Escaped communism, went to Taiwan, reordained, you know, awakening. I wanted to revive the educational level of monks and nuns, but there was no infrastructure whatsoever. Taiwan in the early modern period, definitely in the pre-modern time, was a place that the mainlanders sent to, like, kind of like Australia to the British. You know, the Aborigines there, there's no infrastructure there. And into the 20th century, in the beginning, it was kind of like that, you know? Mm-hmm. So, no infrastructure. And he was the first Chinese monastic with a fourth grade degree or any education degree through his own publication, writings, got into graduate school in Japan. Full sponsorship, you know. And he wanted to modernize Buddhism. In Japan, he witnessed different forms of Japanese Buddhism, learned. Japan was a little ahead of us, Taiwan. They're one of the colonizers, right? So they modernized very quickly, witnessing China and Taiwan being cut up by a piece of pie. They owned Taiwan for 50 years, you know, up to 49. So they're one of the colonizers, totally modernized. Every sect of Buddhism had their own university, you know, liberal arts training, not just small. Universities, huge wealth. So he learned how to set up infrastructure of education. But he also had this Chan lineage experience. So, you know, got his degree, went to Taiwan. No one welcomed him. He was a very different monk. It's like getting a driver's license. No cars, sorry. No cars for you to drive. Still no infrastructure. He had to go to America. He had to come here, 1976. And I was invited here because he wasn't really welcome. New York, Bronx, Temple of Great Enlightenment, taught. People, hippies knocking on the door.
Hey, you got meditation here? You got Zen here? Like you got milk here?
You know? So, you want to learn Zen? Come on. A small gathering. And started doing intense retreats. And word got around in Taiwan. He was going back to Taiwan to take care of his teacher's temple who passed away. And then modern momentum and interest in Chan by my teacher. From the West, transmitting back to Taiwan. No one was leading retreats there. No one. And through his publications, modernization, Chan practice. And when I met Thai, Thich Nhat Hanh, I discovered that Thich Nhat Hanh reads Chinese. He's been reading my teacher's books in Chinese. Because he was also into modernizing in his own way. You know, this was a period. This was in the air. So, and I met him. You know, so his teacher passed away, 77. So now he had to go back and forth, back and forth, back and forth.
Can you speak a little bit about just what he was like as a master, as a person, as a teacher? Yeah. You know, just
I'm getting to that.
Okay.
Relax.
I'm just playing the role of the interviewer.
I appreciate that. And, you know, his culture was two, really. You want to know what he's like? Monastic and the army. Poor monks, young monks, to escape communism. You can't afford to pay for a boat. You got to join the youth army to escape communism. Go to Taiwan and try to figure your way out of it, you know? So these two cultures really shaped him. So he was outwardly stern. When he wants to be humorous, he can very humorous. You know. But inside, stern. You know. So that's why his Dharma name, his teacher gave him the Dharma name, is Zhi Gong Wei Rou. It's just the reverse. Aware of sternness, but only through softness. That's what he needed, you know? Mm-hmm. But he had to kind of, but him and I clicked. Him and I clicked. When I met him, you know, he really took a liking of me. Mm-hmm. Age 10, when I met him, 10, 11, it was around that time. You know, I wanted to learn Kung Fu. I was being bullied, you know? I wanted to learn Kung Fu. He says, yeah, come, I'll teach you Kung Fu. He never taught me anything. He taught me meditation. But I knew that about him, but for him to say that, he was bantering with me, like, yeah, I'll teach you Qing Gong, which is a particular Kung Fu that you can, you know, fly through walls and all this. So I was like, yeah, I want to learn that. He says, yeah, my teacher walk up the other wall, across the ceiling, come down the other one. I knew he was kidding, but the way he can say that and the way he related to me, it was different. Yeah. It reminded me of, you know, my ascetic teacher, and it was very warm. So he really took me and encouraged me to meditate and mm-hmm. encouraged me to do anything I want at the center, just as long as I show up. You know, sometimes people have classes, I get bored, I go upstairs and draw pictures of Buddha. Mm-hmm. You know, Buddha. And his classes, he needed the blackboard, you know. But he didn't want to erase the Buddha. So he would have his classes kind of writing around it, you know. Mm-hmm. It was a joy that to see him, see me, accept me. Mm-hmm. And kind of, you know, establish that relationship. Any questions that I had, I would just ask him. He was very accessible at that time, very small group in New York, mm-hmm. Queens. You know, but he had a very stern
side. You lived with him at the Queens Center, the Chan Center. It really was, it wasn't a monastery.
Meditation center.
Center. And yeah. And you just sort of lived with him and really became his disciple, his attendant, and
learned. I moved in 1991 when I graduated. I had a girlfriend for 4 years. Beautiful. Portuguese. I'm still friends with her. I had to tell her. First time, tears crying. Okay, I don't move in. Second time, tears. Third time, I just moved in. And I called. She had a few times of preparation, you know. She used to come to that. So during college, I lived in another temple, mm-hmm. in the edge of Chinatown, mm-hmm. and Little Italy, mm-hmm. Center Street, mm-hmm. you know, police station right across the street. And she used to come visit, mm-hmm. you know, join the services.
Okay.
Yeah. So, 91, I moved in, and that monk, the master was also an ascetic. He copied the Avatamsaka Sutra mm-hmm. in his own blood.
Mm-hmm.
10 fingers and the sublingual part of his tongue drew blood. Avatamsaka Sutra, mind you, is tens and thousands mm-hmm. of characters. He wrote each character about this big in China. His six-year retreat. So I have this attraction with ascetics.
Can you just maybe, for those who aren't used to this kind of tradition, maybe explain why somebody would do that? I mean, it could sound very bizarre or...
So this practice textually can be traced back to Mahayana scriptures. Of course, in a fantastical way of great bodhisattvas flying around, manifesting and offering their skin as paper, bone as pen, blood as ink, to manifest thousands of scriptures for perpetuity. May the Dharma continue. It's all metaphorical, I think. Now, these scriptures, when it came to China, it became embodied. The Chinese had his own trend of asceticism, hermits, hermetic tradition. So the blending of these teachings and the beginning embodiment of this, asceticism, the ascetic trend, it's yes, in Buddhism, the middle way, avoiding extremes, that's on a prescriptive level, rhetorical level. At the Buddha's time, his own disciple, Mahakashapa, was known as asceticism number one. It's always been present, different forms of it, right? And not copying scripture in blood. Why would Chinese do that? Because China is an empire of texts. The Indians, they don't keep texts. They don't even keep records, But the Chinese have texts dating back to BCE time. We have 3rd century BCE and earlier and so on. So this is what the Chinese do to text. They embody literally the text. India, there's different kinds of senses. Late antiquity, Christianity, ascetics, Christian ascetics. And you see in the Dunhuang, northwestern region of China, cave, the Silk Road. Mm-hmm. Heard of the Silk Road? These caves, you find Nestorian Christian crosses next to Buddhist material good dating back to thousands of years. Why? They live side by side. So this tendency. So it continued to the modern time. So he preferred this, taught in the scriptures.
So let me ask you, so you were a monastic for how many years? You lived the life of a monk?
About 19 years a monk. Living with my teacher, traveling with him. Before that, and then entering the monastichood, traveling with him.
You were like his attendant, his assistant, his translator.
I wore a lot of hats.
So you were very close with him.
Very close. Yeah, I was his first attendant. He always wanted to travel alone. He was a loner. So he was not used to having an attendant. So he put me on a bar, very high bar of, because he's usually doing things himself. You know how when you do things yourself, you can do it the best way? So he put this 20-year-old, everything that I'm doing is wrong. Forgetful, this. So he trained me how to take care of people, how to care for them, how to be present to them, how to share the Dharma. So that relationship became stronger. And then I left monasticism.
Yeah, so maybe, so you want to talk about, so you're monastic for 9 or 10 years, celibate, monastic, fully involved, and at some point you feel something obviously stirring within you. That made a major shift in your life, outwardly.
I really think I was telling someone the other day, monasticism, you know, aside from the romantic version, which is not true, the lived experience really have to do with personality types. That's what it comes down to, personality types. There were multiple conditions that were, you could say, not favorable, but you could also say it's favorable. Why? I was his attendant. My schedule was different. In New York, Sangha is small. And I kept on, every 3 months I'm gone. I'm with my teacher. No close tie. Misunderstandings develop. Big Sangha in Taiwan. I'm just a foreign kid, grew up in the West. I'm not a part of them. They don't see me as part of them. So I'm kind of end up, and the East Asian culture, they prop the teacher up to be, they prop me up too, because I was the only one having close access to him. So I was pushed away from them, you know. So it was, and I say personality types because it really comes down to what type of person, character, upbringing would flourish in a particular context. Mm-hmm. It's just the causes and conditions. Mm-hmm. You know? Me, as you know, if you get a feel for me, even during this time, practice for me is about connection. It's about relationship with people. Yeah. So that, and then working with him, he was my only connection. You know? And he, the way he utilized me, you know, was to put me at the forefront of opening fields, right? I'm not the type that into bureaucracy, you know, structure, you know, do your role, play your role. I'm not that type. So he put me to how to investigate Western culture. Right? He had me read psychology, humanistic psychology, and then he, big why? Because he used to be invited to give talks like Zen and postmodernism. Both of us are scratching our heads. Postmodernism. I had to read like postmodernism, really like Foucault. What? So what is, I'm majoring art when I was in college. You know, so I had to read, like got really involved, and I got involved with psychology. Especially humanistic psychology, systems theory, the business realm, because corporations will invite us. The business systems theory, dependent origination, interconnectedness. You know? So I'm like, so he's kind of rearing me this way. And somehow that, you talk about stirred, that stirred another side, a void within monasticism that I couldn't find. You know, interconnection, relationship, and bringing the Dharma outside the wall. I mean, he used to provide some structure for us, you know, something called the gate of Amrita, elixir. Basically counseling center in the monastery. So you have these 20, early 30 year olds. I was the youngest one, early 20. Counseling people like businessmen, businesswomen coming to us with family problems. Complete hypocrite. Hypocrite. We didn't know training in that. One of us is graduate college. And we just recite the sutra 10,000 times. That should help. So this became within me more I understood Western culture, dive into the history and the trend and the relationship with Westerners. I was in charge of Western Dharma teacher training, relationship. From his perspective, unfortunate, but it was inevitable. But from the perspective now, it's all good.
It's all good.
It's meant to be. So the rigidity of the monastery. Let me tell you about Chinese monasticism. It's even more Confucius than Confucianism. Confucianism died out ages ago. What continued that kind of decorum, the way you carry yourself, the hierarchy? What do you think carries that? Monasticism. And here I was, ex-skinhead, hardcore, straight edge, you know, musician, and then art, and then get into this philosophical tradition for him to give a talk and all that. It just became wider and wider and wider. And then eventually I told him, Shifu, how can you spread Chan in the West when you don't understand them?
Yeah.
I was able to talk to him like that.
Good.
You know? And he said to me, You don't have to be sick to be a doctor. A doctor doesn't have to have cancer.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds reasonable, right?
Yeah.
It's
what we call a false analogy.
So I said to him, I said, you don't know their suffering. They don't connect with you. You're up there. So your situation perpetuates this polarity. There's always something to aspire to. Principles. And mind you, his background. Monastic. Military. He was a radio telegrapher in the radio. He didn't actually hold guns. But aloof.
So was that very, even though I'm sure it was hard in a certain way, it seemed at that point sort of like very natural, this is the next thing for you, even though it obviously was a big reorientation of your life.
Yeah.
So you kind of just knew that this was right.
Well, no.
No?
We should, after this, we should steer to some practice questions, you know, too much about guagu. But I grilled you about Fred.
And as you know, your life is your practice.
Yeah. You know, I wanted to get some air in that claustrophobic Queens meditation center. You know, and there was already tension. It was marginalized again, you know, for different reasons, you know. Privilege. I mean, a larger Sangha. I wanted to get some air. So what I thought, what can I do? I should bring Buddha Dharma outside of walls. I'll get a master's degree, social work. I'll do a little Buddhist studies. You know. I applied to one place because that place has my teacher's longtime student as a professor, Dan Stevenson. Dan Stevenson, great scholar. We're very close friends. I didn't apply anywhere else. I applied to study with him in Kansas. So I'm there in my robe and bicycle. They thought I was Muslim. You know, my robe kind of looked like, you know, I didn't know what I was. So taking social work classes, I wanted to take clinical social work. That's the quickest way to kind of interact with people. So, but they have basic courses you have to do, practicum. Where? Senior citizen home. In my robe, in Kansas. So I was going there in my robe, and you know, I wanted to talk about the real substance, like facing death and life. I had read a book during that time. It's called Tuesdays with Rory. I was like, great, I get to talk with these people about it. They just want to play. They restricted me from talking, you know? This one for balls. You know? For ball, that's for ball. Yeah. I'm like... And I exercise, well, they don't want to face.
No.
I found out American culture, no one wants to face death.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the culture, they put old people together, tuck it away, out of sight, out of mind. You know, so that didn't work too well, and then I continue it anyway. And after a year of that, I said, Shifu. That's how I address my teacher. I said, Shifu, I'm gonna try. I'm gonna return to lay life. I'm gonna find my way. Find my way. He says, if you jump into the ocean with all the waves, you may not be back. You may drown. And I said, in the exterminator way, I'll be back.
But that's really very traditional to have that, you know, from the monastic point of view, it's like they're in this ocean of Dharma sanity, and out there is this world of desire and ignorance, and, you know, so very dualistic. So I think we're running out of time. So you went, and eventually you got a PhD in Buddhist studies. You manifested yourself as a professor, and yet as obviously has continued as a lay teacher, as an heir to your teacher's dharma. So how
I
do you
wanted say- to come back after a year. I was like, samsara. My teacher says, I thought you want to save all beings. All sentient beings. No. He says, finish your degree. He didn't tell any of the lay people, the hundreds and thousands that support Dharma Chomrin, is that Guo Gu actually returned to lay life, because aside from him, I was the one teaching in Taiwan, in the monastery, to hundreds of people.
Mm-hmm.
So he says, you can't come back until you got something to show, you know, get a PhD. I was like, okay, get a PhD, you know?
Yeah.
So, but, you know, the PhD, and then during the PhD, he told me, your path is have a family. Fulfill your dream. You bring Chan to the West. You find a way. And I continue to support him. He's continued to support me. You know, support me. For example, he established a Shenyan Chair of Buddhist Studies at Florida State University. So I have a position.
How wonderful.
Yeah.
So we have family program today, so soon the children will be in and they can report. So I'm interested, so having, you know, grown up in Taiwan, you know, Chinese culture, having spent 10 years, you know, very much in that monastic culture, how is it different? What is it like teaching people like us? You know what I'm saying? I mean, how is the American mind, the Western mind, different? You know, in terms of just teaching, you know, what have you learned about this culture? Because again, one of the things you said was to Shifu, yeah, they're suffering, but you don't really understand who they are.
Yeah.
So what have you come to understand?
So I suffered.
Yeah. Yeah.
What is it like to be manipulated? What it is like to be used, tossed aside? What is it like to witness death, what is it like to meet? I mean, if you're in the monastery, you're sheltered. Everyone's like-minded, they want to be there, they're practicing. What is it like to meet people that despise you? No reason. Karmically, there's reasons, but just, pain, suffering, and reflecting my life. It was a year of between master's degree and PhD. I wanted to go to Harvard because there was one scholar, not because of the name, Harvard, there's one scholar I want to study with. I got on the waiting list, didn't get in, but I already moved there. So I got a job. I couldn't find a job. I got a job as a doorman. Plaid suit, plastic shoes and everything. Asking people, do you have your ID? Big Boston corporate building. People are taking their exercise break in between the work, Humility. I learned humility. There's no agent there. They look at me like, must be a loser. So here I was in the monastery, hundreds of practitioners bow down. Asking people, do you have your ID to get into the building? No. And it was during that time that, in a shelter environment, under the close watch, tutelage, training of my teacher, I had some powerful experiences. But they never came alive. It never came alive. It was dead wisdom, because I was sheltered.
Oh, yeah.
It came alive in Boston, hanging out with my brothers. African-American descent, all of us just hanging out. All of them, they had their slogan, struggling, struggling, right? To pay bills. In monastery, you take away relationships and you take away bills. What's left? Of course you think you're practicing well. Can't pay bills, struggling. The kind of humility, struggling, finding my way, a natural kind of wonderment. What is this? What is this? Is this my life? I got a master's degree. I'm asking for door ID. What is this? What is this? Day in and day out for months, about 4 or 5 months of that. And all of a sudden, one of my co-worker brothers handing the bill. I was preparing for taking the GRE again, one pocket. Words that you will never use in your life ever again, vocab. Another one, math equations. That's what I do. I'm not allowed to sit down all day long. Inside this, grinding inside me. What is it? What is this life? I got myself into the, my teacher won't take me back. I had to get into a PhD program. And then one day, doing my thing, just standing there. Deep in my struggle, my coworker says, over here, can I see your ID, please? Talking, joking around with some other people. It's all good, man. It's all good. When I heard, it's all good. Everything dropped. Then the Dharma became the blood that flowed through my veins.
Mm-hmm.
And the suffering and the struggle. And then Princeton accepted me. PhD. I was like, okay, I guess I go there.
When causes the condition, inside causes the condition change, other things, condition open up. That's the way.
Great doubt. So in Chan, you know, great doubt. Great doubt produces great enlightenment, and that's what you're saying. But it was very natural. It wasn't the koan practice in the monastery, but it was your own, your own question.
It was life. Suffering. So the difference between monasticism and lay life and everyday life. Life. Blood that flow through your veins. Your life and all the struggles and all the beauty. That is your practice. Aligning that with the freedom that's within, how to be free in the midst of all of that, how to be free. It's always there, it's always been there. So bring it forth. Don't let the Dharma just be up here reading books. How to find that freedom within, in the midst of life.
You know, I just want to stop here. I mean, this is it. No more needs to be said. So we'll wait for the kids to come. We can just sit here a few moments and let kind of marinate in what we've heard today. He shared his journey from the inside, right? You know, we all, unfortunately, we see each other from the outside, right? And rarely do we get an opportunity to go inside, you know? And when we all go inside, there we find our commonality, right? So I think what Guru's sharing today has touched us deeply. So let's just spend a few moments just sitting, kind of marinating in what he shared with us. Deep bow. Our usual way of resolving our sufferings is to make external changes, to try to manipulate the external environment. But what's been shared with us today is there is another way. It is dealing with it directly inside us and finding that freedom and liberation from within. So it's a very powerful teaching we received today.